I'm Michael, I'm an alcoholic. I am extremely privileged to be here today at this meeting and to be asked to share, and I'd like to thank Karen for asking me to come up here and share a few weeks ago. And as most people would know, I haven't given it any thought. I woke up this morning and I did a fabulous chair in my head. But it's not the same standing up here, you know. I'm a grateful alcoholic today. I love the theme of this convention, you know, which is another chance. And there's a beautiful line in Came to Believe, which says, became a member of the Second Chance Society. And I really believe that I got a second chance at life when I found recovery. And I didn't find recovery, I didn't just walk in. I had to have a journey. And, you know, what it was like for me and what it's like today is absolutely worlds apart. I grew up in a family where I was the youngest and I had four sisters and two older brothers and my mother and father. And a huge effect on me was my father died in 1973 when I was 10. And I found that, you know, I was a young child, and I found that loss really difficult, because in those days there was no such thing as counselling, or, you know, my mother just had to get on and find a new life. She'd looked after her husband for years till he died of cancer, and it was huge on the family. And, you know, there was a lot of alcohol in our house, and there was a lot of dysfunction. And my mother was a beautiful woman and did her very best. I grew up with this sense of loss, a sense of abandonment, and I never understood that, you know. And when I took my first drink, I bawled my eyes out listening to Leonard Cohen. And a lot of people would say, anyone would do that because it's very sad music. But I didn't do that because of that. And I didn't understand why most times when I drank, I would cry. And the people that I hung around with were a lovely, lovely group of people. You know, we didn't get into trouble, but we did drink. And the one thing I remember a lot about my drinking was, you know, when I took that first drink at age 14 or thereabouts, you know, there was this drink that was going around at the time, was Marie Celeste. It was like a wine, you know, and everybody drank it. And when I took that first drink, it deadened my feelings. And I thought this was magic. I felt 10 foot tall. And it was a really, you know, I really liked this stuff because it gave me courage, you know. But what alcohol done for me, and in those days it was grand, you know, we drank in fields, it was no problem. You know, I had hangovers, but it was fine. It wasn't a big problem. You know, and the one of the regrets of my life, you know, and it says in the promises, you know, we don't regret the past, no wish to shut the door on it. And I have no regrets in most of my life. But one of the things I remember I'd done, which was a crazy thing to do as a 16-year-old, I decided to stop hanging around with the gang I was hanging around with, because I thought, you know, I got to live a hippie lifestyle and I'm going to go out on my own and hang around on my own, you know. And I'd done that. And I started drinking on my own, and I started playing music on my own in a parlour. And I used to go to late night concerts on my own, and I used to go to late night shows on my own. And it was a very lonely experience. I don't understand, like, why I'd done that, because the friends that I had used to call to the door. And they'd say, you know, you're coming to hang around with us. And I'd say, oh, no, I'm okay now, I'm okay. You know, I'm going to hang around on my own. And I did that for about a year. And it was a very lonely experience, you know. And of course, I thought the drink was helping me, because again, it was suppressing these feelings of loss. And you know, my mother was going on a pilgrimage to Lourdes with her sisters. And, you know, I was only young at the time. And she said, my sister was going, and she said, would you like to go? And I had the image of Lourdes that it was like Paris, you know. And I used to listen to a guy like Jean-Michel Jarre, and I had this image that I was going to go to this really, I mean, it was a pilgrimage. But, you know, I didn't understand that. And I went in that, and I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I met a woman there who was part of the group that I was at, and we fell in love, you know. And you know, my drinking really took off then, you know. But I blamed her. You know, I blamed her. And my mother, God love her at the time, she used to say to me, you know, say, if you weren't with her, you wouldn't be drinking the way you're drinking. And I believed it. I said, oh, you're right. But that's not true. Like, nobody forced me to drink. You know, I drank because I wanted it, and there was never enough drink. You know, I hated the end of the night when the bar was closing. I wanted to get as much drink as I could. You know, we ended up getting married. We had a huge amount of arguments before that. You know, I had come out from you know, being isolating myself into a relationship that I was not ready for. But you know, there's a saying in Ireland, like, old heads on young shoulders. And I thought I was an adult. I dressed like an adult. You know, I behaved like an adult. Well, I thought I did. You know, and we got married. And, you know, I mean, I was in the pub before we went to the church. You know, there's so many crazy times. And I thought I was going to have, you know, a fantastic marriage. This was going to be, you know, this is what I've waited for all my life. Freedom, you know, so a new place to live. You know, I'm going to have security and everything is going to be good. And it didn't turn out that way. You know, we had two lovely kids, and my drinking took completely off then. You know, and I went into complete resentment. I blamed her for everything. And I used to say to myself, you know, if she wasn't, and this is no disrespect to her today, and I'm grateful for the steps that, you know, I was able to make amends. But I used to say to myself, you know, if she wasn't the person that she is, I would be a happier person. Then I used to say, if my kids weren't acting out, crying all the time, I wouldn't be the miserable person that I am. And what I'd done, and I had no understanding of what I was doing. I used to make excuses that, you know, I've got to go down and pay a bill, or I've got to go somewhere. But what I was doing was I was going to the pub, you know, and I was always feeling sorry for myself. You know, one of the patterns of my life that I learned in the fourth step was I was a victim and I was full of self-pity and I didn't know how to get out of that. You know, I really believed the answer was in the end of a bottle. And, you know, as that marriage went on, it got worse and the arguments got worse. And my two sons were totally affected and they were very young at the time. And they were looking at two parents tearing themselves apart. You know, one trying to outdo the other. And, you know, I could only see that, you know, I was the victim. I couldn't fix it because I didn't, I just blamed. That's all I could do. And the saving grace for me was, you know, to go and get drunk. You know, or maybe not come home that night. Or maybe sleep in the car. I do crazy things, really feeling sorry for myself. And then coming back to the house and expecting open arms. And not understanding why that doesn't happen. You know, when I think of those times, I think of, like, who was that person in those days? You know, in 1989, I ended up with two black sacks on the streets. And I was really more of a victim then. Now I had something really, like, my kids had been taken off me, and I'd been kicked out of the house, and I'd done nothing wrong. And that's being truthfully honest. And I can say that today, but I couldn't say that at the time because I would go to my mother. And of course my mother would stand up for me and say, you know, it was her fault. She was the one at fault. And I went along with that. But that's not the truth. You know, I had my part to blame in it, but I couldn't see it. And you know, I got bitterness after that breakup. I ended up in a dumpy little flat feeling really sorry for myself. And you know, the crazy thought came to my mind when I was in that flat was, now I can drink and nobody can say anything to me. So I can wake up in the morning, which I did, and I can drink cans. You know, and I took time off work because I was stressed. I was stressed because I was drinking. But I never said that to the job. I always said, you know, if you were going through what I'm going through, you'd be the same. You won't be able to work. But you know, the drinking, I thought the drink was going to get better. I thought I was going to have this where I'd be drinking and I'd be like, oh my God, this is fantastic. But I got more miserable. And then I said to myself, well, it's because of this flat I'm in. It's a dumpy flat. It's cold. But it wasn't that, you know. It was the drink that was causing it. And again, it was the victimhood. And, you know, I went around bars when I had money, you know, really slagging off my ex and people I didn't know. And I said, oh, well, I'll tell you what, this and that happened and that. And, like, it was totally one-sided. And it wasn't the truth. You know, and in 1994, for really reasons of don't need to go into here today, my sons were put in the hospital and their half-sister was put in the hospital. And I couldn't abandon them, you know, so I took custody of them at that time. So they had a dad who now was the parent. They had a mother who had her own difficulties and a half-sister who had been taken off them. So they were divided up and they came to live with me. And I had this dream that we were going to have this perfect family life. But my drinking was just as bad. And then I fell in again to the victimhood of, look at me now, I'm a single dad, I'm trying to work, I'm trying to manage two young boys who have come from a completely dysfunctional family. How am I going to cope with this? And I'm going to have to try work. And I have to say, it was extremely difficult in those days. And I drank in those days to cope. You know, I drank to cope with you know, dealing with life, dealing with schools, dealing with, you know, unmanageable behaviour. And I'm talking about myself as well here, you know. Like, there's many days that my sons would have to come and meet me in the pub because I would go to the pub after work and their dinner would be chips out of the chipper. You know, it wasn't roses. And the amazing and the crazy thing is, if you ask them today, they're 37 and 34. If you ask them today, they'd say, oh, they were crazy times. We loved them. They were great times. But they're not my recollection of those times. Like, I used to bring them away and we'd stay in hostels in Paris or somewhere like that, and it sounds fantastic, but the reason I picked that city was there was 24-hour drinking and I knew where I could get the bottles, and you know, and I knew that they could be in the hostel with me, and I've had many instances getting off the plane there where I was absolutely pissed and they had to carry me. And there are times that I, you know, I want to always remember those times and not forget what I was like in those days. And I'm grateful that they're not like that today. You know, I'm bringing up two boys was really difficult and really painful. And as they got teenagers, it got more difficult. I expected that we were going to have a very easy journey. It didn't turn out that way. And I'm not here to talk about them. I'm here to talk about me. And we are really good friends today, and that is a gift from this program, you know. So where did I find this program? You know, I had two rock bottoms. You know, first rock bottom I had, I didn't know what was happening. The drink wasn't working. I wasn't coping. I didn't know where to go. So I turned to a doctor who suggested to go to this alcohol treatment place in Dublin. I ended up going to this counsellor. I had no idea what Alcoholics Anonymous was. I had no idea what it's like to not drink. I had no idea what a 12-step program was. And I had absolutely no idea what an alcoholic was. I wasn't an alcoholic because I didn't lose my house. I didn't lose my job, you know. So I wasn't an alcoholic. I just couldn't cope with life. So I was looking for someone to help me to cope with life. And I went to that counsellor and she said she'd help me, but they hadn't got the programme at the time. So I did a one-to-one with her. And it was the first time that I felt support. You know, my family gave me support, but they gave it in a totally different way. You know, it was unconditional love. And my family were fabulous. They wanted nothing but the best for me. But not around alcohol. Like, my mother used to say to me, you know, don't go drinking. And of course I used to say, oh, I won't go drinking. But I was always going to go drinking. You know, I was defiant. I always went against any suggestions. But that counsellor, and it says it in the big book, you know, resentments are the number one offender. I went to that counsellor, and I can't to this day remember. She said something about social services, and I instantly said to her, do you know what, I'm never coming back here again. You will never tell me what to do. And it's very true, you know. I went with a huge resentment against that counsellor, and it was a short time after that I went back drinking again, and I went back on that merry-go-round, you know. And I had some horrible, horrible, you know, like emotional turmoil is a way of putting it. I like to think of it as like the wilderness of emotional turmoil. I felt so isolated as I was drinking in the house, hiding away from the world, you know, terrified of the postman coming up the driveway. You know, I used to believe in my head that no one knew I was a drunk. And yet I used to fall up the road so many times. So I don't know how I had this image that people didn't realise how much of a drunk I was. But I was trying to hide from the world. And eventually what happened to me was I hit another rock bottom. But this was my higher power's, you know, answer. It was the help that I really needed. Because, you know, faith without works is dead. I would have done nothing without hitting rock bottom. I would have kept drinking. Because it was the only solution for me. But the second rock bottom that I had, and I always remember it, you know, I was drinking for days, because I never just drank for one day. You know, I was supposed to go to work on Monday and I'd end up drinking. You know, that decision, many times I used to get up for work and say, I am going to work today, and I would end up in an early morning house drinking. I could never understand why that happened to me. You know, I have to go to work, and I would end up drinking. And then the more I drank, the more I would say, well, to hell with the job. No one cares about me, so I don't care about them. And that job was extremely good to me. They could have sacked me many, many times, and they didn't. And I will always be grateful to that company, always. But when I hit that rock bottom, I was drinking in a bar. Funny enough, the drink just didn't work. I was drinking, it wasn't doing anything for me, and I felt totally suicidal. I felt like, you know what, and this is the selfish part of my alcoholism, I felt like I wanted to die, and yet I had two small sons who needed me, and I thought, you know, I would rather die because I can't cope with life. And I sat at that bar thinking to myself, you know, how can I get out of this mess? And I came to a conclusion, I'm going to go to a doctor and I'm going to ask the doctor to sign me into a mental institution. And I really believed that a doctor could just do that. And I didn't even know this doctor. I used to pick random doctors because I needed a doctor's note for work. And I picked this doctor thinking, like, she's going to sort me. And doctors don't do that. You know, she said to me, like, you know, you can go back, we can get you a psychiatrist. And again, that took time. And she said, you know, I would recommend that you go back to the centre that you went the first time round. And of course, I didn't want to go back there because I was full of guilt and shame. Also, I was full of the resentment that, you know, I had been really narky to this counsellor. And I couldn't face her again. But she said, you know, you can go back there. And again, when I went to the psychiatrist, I was hoping the psychiatrist was going to fix me. But fix me so as I could drink. Because I came to a conclusion that, you know, because I came to many conclusions in my drinking, that, you know, I'm going to find the answer. I'm going to find the solution to why I'm so crazy. You know, why I'm such a weirdo. Why I'm not like you people. You know, and the conclusion I came to was, I've had a trauma in my life. I was traumatized around my father's time. Something, I could have been dropped on my head when I was a kid. Something happened to me. So I was looking for a solution or an answer. And that psychiatrist I went to was a beautiful woman. And she gave me Librium. But again, I wanted her to give me boxes of it because it would take the pain away. But she didn't. She said, I'll only give you a small amount to stop the shaking and get you back right. But she said, you know, you have to make that phone call to that counsellor again. I can't make that for you. I wanted her to make it. But I made that phone call and I went back to that counsellor, and I always remember that meeting, you know, and I was scared and I said to her, you know, I'm really scared coming here. I don't want to come here. And she said, you know, you have choice. You don't have to come here and do this program. You can go out there and try it on your own, or you can go back drinking. But something had changed in me. I wanted something new. I wanted a different life. I didn't want my sons seeing their dad always pissed out of his head, collapsed on the ground, not going to work, not paying the bills, not getting the food. I wanted a new life. So I went there, you know, and I was grateful to that counsellor. And I met 4 women and 3 men. And it was 8 of us in the group and 2 counsellors. And that's where my journey began. That's where I got identification that I wasn't this crazy, weird person that, you know, drank differently than everyone else and felt differently than everyone else. You know, I was just a drunk and I wanted a new life. And these people were telling me the same thing. And together we got this bond and we got phone numbers. And I was never used to getting hugs. And so one thing I love about, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous and recovery is the hugs. You know, I never got them when I was out there drinking, sitting on my own, feeling really sorry for myself. But, you know, we got phone numbers and we started supporting each other. And that's where I started learning about me and my alcoholism, the effect that I had. Because, you know, when we came to the question of how many people did I affect around me, I said, no, I didn't affect anybody. No, I was a loner. I didn't hurt no one. But then when it was pointed out to me, I realised how much I took people's minds, how much I upset my mother and family, how much I would turn up at their door, piss down my head looking for tea and sympathy, and then decide when I got that, I'm going off to the pub and leave my mother. Many times I would say, when I'd leave that house, I used to say to her, you know, I'm going off to kill myself. And then forget that I said those words and wake up the next morning and my mother worried sick about me and not understanding why, because I forgot. I forgot all them times, you know. I forgot the damage that I'd done to my sons. You know, I was never reliable. You know, I was there most of the time, but a lot of the times I wasn't there for them. They could not depend on me. You know, they had to search for me in pubs. The most embarrassing thing for them sometimes was they would ring the job looking for me, and I wouldn't be in the job. I'd be in some pub drinking, and they'd have no idea where I was. And, you know, I didn't understand any of that the damage that I was causing. I understand that today, you know. And when I started that group, you know, we did that group for 16 weeks for half a day. And the job I was in were so supportive. I was scared shitless to ask the job about this, you know, to say I'm an alcoholic. But they supported me. And they let me go for the half a day each week. And I worked up the hours time for time. And nobody ever mentioned it. You know, and I started becoming reliable in that job. And of course, the more I became reliable in the job and I stopped drinking, that, you know, the fog started to lift. And then I got the other thing of like thinking that, well, you know, I should get a promotion now. And when jobs came up or promotions came up, I got very disappointed that I didn't get promoted. How could I expect to get promoted when I was only a wet day coming around? You know, I had so many notions at the time. And like what other speakers have said at this, I always remember picking a man out to be my sponsor and, you know, taking time to pluck the courage up. And he was the guy that was going, because everyone liked this man. And he used to pour the tea at the meeting. And I said, yeah, he's definitely the right man for me. And I had to pluck up the courage, and I went over to him after a meeting, and I said to him, look, I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said, no. But he didn't say it like that. You know, he just said he couldn't do it. But I took it that he said no in that way, because that was my interpretation. But he was sponsoring a good few people. And I got angry that happened, you know, because I thought in AA people don't say no. But people are entitled to do, you know, their opinion, they're entitled to that. And if you can't do it, you can't do it. It's not out of badness. And I went to another meeting one time, and I was at the meeting, and I was really annoyed. I couldn't get a sponsor. And a guy came over to me, and he says to me, how about I be your temporary sponsor? And, you know, he's still my temporary sponsor today. You know, and he has helped me so much through all of that madness in early recovery. You know, he said, I'll go through the steps with you, through the big book, the same way my sponsor done it with me. You know, and he said, that's all I can do. You know, I'll show you what the way I was shown. And I am so grateful to that man. And that man has listened to a lot of my madness. You know, when I picked up the phone and rang him, and I didn't get him, and I get annoyed that he didn't answer the phone. You know, and I said, look, you're not answering the phone. He says, you know, I have a life. You know, I'm not just sitting at the end of the phone waiting for you to call. I really thought that he was. But all of this language in AA was all new to me. All of this finding my feelings was new. You know, I wasn't used to feeling feelings. You know, I was used to distractions. I was used to suppressing them. It was all completely new way of living for me. And not falling into being the victim. That took a good bit of work. And you know, with that counsellor, I did a 2-year one-to-one with her. And I asked her one day, I said, you know, could I do a few sessions on my responsibility in the marriage? Because I was so used to pointing the finger at other people that it was their fault. And I wanted to do something about that. And I did, and I'm grateful to that counsellor. She listened to, again, a lot of my madness in my head, you know, and, you know, she showed me what it's like to be human. And that I'm a sick person trying to get well. And these are great, great gifts. You know, I absolutely love what recovery gives me today. You know, recovery has given me a completely new way of living, a new pair of glasses. You know, I look at life totally different. I love the 12 steps of AA. I love each step the way it was like a building block for me. You know, and where the fourth step showed me the patterns of my past and, you know, and letting go of those and making the amends to people that I had hurt and accepting reality. And I'm grateful for that, you know. And, you know, working the steps, I never thought I could ever give something away because I never thought I had anything to give. But like when it came to the 12th step, my sponsor used to say to me, you know, you pass it on. That is the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You pass it on. You pass on this gift. And I have to say, it is a precious, precious gift to be able to pass on to another fellow. And I've had the privilege, you know, of being asked to sponsor people. And I've actually pinched myself saying, like, what would I have to give? What would a person see in me? You know, and it is an amazing, amazing privilege. And, you know, I worked in the last job for 18 years and I really believed that, you know, I would be in that job to retirement. You know, I had no other idea until I met my wife 7 years ago and it completely changed the direction of my life. And you know, I would have never guessed that it was going to go that way. You know, and she said to me, like, how about we move to Brussels? And I had a dream when I was drinking that I would have loved to have lived abroad. But I never had that ability because I was always either in debt or the sons were very young and I didn't want to abandon them. I could never do that. But I got a chance 3 years ago and I was scared to do it. And then I was going to retire from the job. I was like, wow, how am I going to do that? And I done it. And it's been a fantastic trip. And like the Brussels Fellowship has been really special to me. And all the fellows that have been there for me have helped me in so, so many ways. And I'm truly grateful for that. And we moved back to Ireland a couple of months ago. And these are all the gifts of the programme. You know, and I have to say, I never thought I'd be standing up here sharing my story. You know, and I do think sometimes that, you know, in a share there is, you know, how can you put into words of what it was like in those days of that drinking days and what it's like today, because today is so, so different and the program is there to help, you know. So I'm a grateful alcoholic here and I've really enjoyed this convention. I think fellowship is really special, but there's something, you know, there's a power in the meetings for me. You know, my sponsor used to say to me, the higher power is in every meeting, right in the middle of the room. And I love that, you know, because I used to feel alone when I was out there. I used to feel like, you know, is this what life's all about? Is this what I'm doom and gloom, misery? And it's not like that today. You know, today I have choices. This morning I woke up with many choices. And I'm grateful for that, you know. So I wish everybody well, and thanks for listening to me.